This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today, I'm joined by the one and only Ben Chang, Managing Director for Public Affairs and Crisis at Burson Mars Teller. Did I do it right?
Yes.
Awesome. So prior to this latest stint, Ben has held many, many jobs, all of them exciting, most notably 18 years as a Foreign Service officer, including stints at the UN and the White House under both President Bush and President Obama. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of what we talk about on What's Next is sort of hard security in a way, or things that come out of hard security.
As opposed to easy security.
Yeah, you know, the easier kind that you do. Just kidding. But sort of, right? You are not a member, or you were not a member of our military, but you are still a retired service person, are you not?
You could say that, I suppose.
So diplomacy has officers, and you were one of them. And it's a different kind of service to the country. It has a different role in national security, but an equally important one. What are your thoughts on that? I know you agree with me.
It's something that has dwelled in my mind ever since I considered taking the Foreign Service exam when I was a junior or senior at Georgetown University. How do we translate what I did and my colleagues continue to do day in and day out to the broader American public, to whom we are in service, ultimately? It's often a bit more diffuse and abstract, yet when in reality, what we do is the most common interaction everybody does just about day to day, which is communicate with other people. It just happens to be that in the field of diplomacy, those people are overseas, look a little bit different often, sometimes speak a different language, and have different interests, priorities, goals, and sometimes the gap between our interests and theirs is wide or narrow. You and I were speaking earlier about military service and the nobility and sacrifice that that entails. For a broad swath of America, that's more tangible in the sense that many folks have military bases in their home states. There are recruitment centers up and down Main Street, if you will. For the State Department, there is less of a tangible reach back to the American public, state by state. Recruitment often occurs on campus, for example, along with others in job fairs. There's less brick-and-mortar presence inside the country. Of course, our presence is overseas. And so that presents an opportunity and a challenge. The opportunity, of course, is that it's overseas where Americans are often first and most in contact or ever in contact with diplomats. I lost my passport. I'm going to get married. I'm having a child. I'm lost.
Especially I'm lost.
Yeah. I have a business opportunity. I want to study. So that's when, and what I consider sort of the front lines of diplomacy, a consular officer at the embassy, which I was in El Salvador back in the 90s, is your point of contact. And for many Americans, it is a really valuable contact, someone that they are really grateful to see visit the hospital, the jail, sometimes the morgue, wherever.
Yeah.
But that's overseas. So if you don't go overseas or don't have a need, then you may not interact with your American diplomats. So how do you translate these benefits to Main Street America? And that's something that I individually was trying to grapple with and therefore devoted much of my career to what we call public diplomacy. And I know that it's an ongoing effort from this administration to the previous and across different agencies to translate the benefits of diplomacy and more broadly development work to Main Street America. When, and one last thought for now is that, for example, it's less tangible to portray via Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right now, it makes for better movie, or should I say cinematic storytelling, to portray the work, the adventures, the tragedies sometimes, of our soldiers and spies. it's a little bit harder to convey that effort of our diplomatic or development professionals overseas. And I say this with a smile because I too much rather go to some of those other movies.
Right.
I mean, look, you have Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, whichever, at a swanky embassy soiree in Vienna.
Okay, right. Fine.
Well, that, first of that all, seems not all great. Of us do that.
Yeah.
And he really wasn't a diplomat. He was a spy.
Yeah.
You've got Gwyneth Paltrow in sort of a murder mystery movie back in the day. And I remember watching it. Her job was the one I had, which was the special assistant to the ambassador at the UN.
Special assistants are great people.
Oh, yeah. Madam Secretary, here are your talking points.
Yes.
They're the same as you gave in Geneva last week. I never actually uttered those words, though I did work for Madam Secretary in Madeleine Albright. But the bottom line is that even through the wonderful public diplomacy vehicle of Hollywood, it's a bit more difficult to get traction for that kind of storyline.
You know, I was having a very similar conversation to this a few days ago with a friend who both them and I have had the privilege to see the musical Hamilton. And there's a line in the show where Hamilton is determining whether then President Washington is going to ask him to be Secretary of Treasury or Secretary of State. And as we all know, he became Secretary of Treasury. And the question we were batting around between us was, if he had become Secretary of State, would the musical have been as interesting? And to us, you know, people who care about this, it would in fact have been just as interesting. But would it have been as easy a story to tell? And I'm not saying that Hamilton was written easily. That's not my point, right? But there's something a little bit more complicated. It requires perhaps a longer attention span than we naturally give to broader issues that we don't understand how they impact us, to explain why diplomacy matters, right? So I wonder, when we don't have the attention span maybe we should, if it's limited to 140 characters, how do we use diplomacy as effectively and efficiently as we can for our national security interest? Because it's an important tool.
I would not purport to have any great answers ready for Broadway.
Sure.
My great fear would be that someone is cooking up a hip-hop musical about diplomacy, because you have to try something new, right? That's
right,
been done.
Right. That's true.
So it's sort of like, let's make the next Pokemon Go. Don't make that, because that's
it's
done.
You're not gonna, right. So nobody do that.
Right, exactly. And as you know, a DJ on the side, again.
So
I
if
would
it would be
like,
anyone, it'd be you. Yeah.
No, I know not to do that. That's but there have been practitioners of the art that have broken through, if you will. And I referred to one just a minute ago, my old boss, Madeleine Albright, who for many reasons really broke through, you know, ceilings and made of glass and otherwise and so on, immigrant story, to achieve a profile that did transcend sort of the building, if you will, at Foggy Bottom.
Right.
There are ways to do it. I think that we now have a whole cohort of Foreign Service officers, of diplomats, of State Department servants who are exploring ways to push the boundaries and of messaging and to get the word out, because everyone has to. I'm now in the private sector at a public affairs agency that is global, Burson Marsteller, and we're all looking at traditional media, social media, how we can use data and analytics to look at effective messaging and audience reception.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, and one reason I'm in this field now and what I did in the Foreign Service is that it's about interacting with people. Now, you can have different platforms to do that, but it's about interacting with people. Right now, this podcast,
right,
should it see the light of day, which I hope at the end of this you feel it merits it, is about reaching people. And what your organization does, what I try to do in my personal capacity now, is all about that. And we need to continue that and find like-minded people willing to join voices in a chorus that end up on a Broadway stage.
Right.
But, you know, they continue that. But there are ways to find like-minded institutions or people who can help carry that voice. Frankly, just more broadly, I am heartened. I don't mean to ding the land of Hollywood. I was in Los Angeles for a brief sundappled,
right,
short-lived stint last year. We are seeing more of Hollywood in Washington, and not just in the spring for the White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend, but rather efforts to make the storytelling through movies more realistic, more grounded in policy truth and processes. And so I'm glad to see that flourish, that exchange of ideas. And many of my former Obama administration colleagues have decamped for the West Coast, and I think are slowly infusing that ethos as well. So we'll see. But I think it's a constant mandate on the part of professional diplomats and the community around them to find ways to communicate, because what I woke up with each day and what I was reminded when I was sworn in as a Foreign Service officer, as you said, I was an officer commissioned, a Senate confirmation, different from having to testify or to have a hearing, but we all have a little piece of parchment when you join the Foreign Service, is that not only are we beneficiaries of taxpayer money, yours, mine, everyone's, but we are serving the American people.
Right.
And it impacts me on quite a level when I'm watching the debate unfold on the campaign trail, for example, that we're experiencing right now, or any other time, when there are broad brush barbs thrown at institutions like the State Department or diplomacy, or broadly the federal government, to say that they do not serve the American people or don't have the American people's interests in mind. I have an issue with the general notion that people bandy about rather loosely and glibly, the term American people.
Right.
But I do think it's important for all of us to remember who we serve, and why we're doing this, whether it's from something as lofty or and controversial as the Iran deal to implementing the Immigration and Naturalization Act overseas by issuing visas. All of that matters because it's about the fabric of our society and has an important role. And I'm pretty passionate about that and trying to explore ways like this discussion of how you communicate that.
So one point that I've brought up to some other guests we've had on the show, and that is always of interest to me, particularly when I'm talking to Foreign Service officers, retired Foreign Service officers, or military officers, is how we approach confirmation hearings, particularly when we compare how we approach the confirmation of a combatant commander versus how we approach the confirmation of a career Foreign Service officer for an to be an ambassador. How the Senate and Congress approaches those two very similar things is very different. I'm thinking of the process when you're an ambassador, is significantly more political. Those appointments get held up. And it seems to be because, as you said, these broad brushes of the State Department or diplomacy in general, we being the Senate, I'm not a senator, but nonetheless, seem to feel detached from what diplomacy is and the purpose it serves us. Never mind the fact that to be a career Foreign Service officer is an incredibly selective and arduous process, and that the only people who attend, you know, command staff college aside from our military officers are Foreign Service officers. So two groups of people who go through very similar processes, very similar training, very similar goals, though different ways of getting there, we treat them so differently. And I wonder what you think the impact is on our national security, whether it's, you know, other countries see that we don't value a relationship with them because we don't have an ambassador there, or we put ourselves at greater risk because we don't have a permanent senior presence there. What does it seem like to you?
My first thought turns to the question of cost, that there may be an element of a weighing of cost and benefit, that it costs less to a particular elected representative or group to hold up an ambassadorial nomination for reasons unrelated to their qualifications than it would a combatant commander Mm-hmm. It's just a question.
Right.
And this goes back to my broader point about the State Department and our diplomatic and development institutions cultivating constituencies within the United States. That's just a open-ended question.
Yeah.
But I think that might be a factor because in the instances I've seen of friends and colleagues whose nominations have been held for reasons unrelated to their qualifications, there can be diplomatic entreaties. There can be questions about upcoming visits or negotiations. And some arguments carry more weight than others.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you need domestic constituencies to begin to step up and raise questions and really raise pressure to get things shaken loose. It is heartening to see more and more of, if you will, corporate America talking about the importance of being engaged in the world.
Sure.
About having full funding for the 150 account that funds the State Department, among mm-hmm. other institutions. About working with the Secretary of State on issues of what Secretary Clinton called economic statecraft. Working with the president on an export council, for example, because all these things are tied together and often cross different agencies. I also am heartened by seeing cross-agency collaboration, and the Department of Commerce working with the Department of State and others to translate the benefits of our presence overseas to Americans. And then that takes us into the question of trade. And in this particular climate we're in right now, it's a little worrisome to see what has often been a bipartisan commitment to American engagement through trade around the world, a little bit under question, being assailed a little bit, actually much more so on one side than the other right now. My hope is that once the dust settles, that we'll return to that bipartisan commitment to being engaged on trade and trade agreements around the world. We also need to continue to do it. Now, I'm speaking as if I were still in government, but we, as being in Washington, need to be clear on translating the benefits of trade and maybe also looking a little bit more at mitigating the downside. Clearly, an issue on both sides for this campaign season.
And do you think we, as the U.S. government or people who are engaged in these conversations, are doing an increasingly better job of engaging people on diplomacy and its importance? Are there things you're seeing in the work that's happening that makes you say, yes, we are headed in the right direction, we are doing this well? Or are you mostly kind of seeing people are working hard but not getting the support they need? You know, are we moving in the right direction, the wrong direction? We're not moving at all? I'm not sure.
I think we're moving at different speeds in different lanes. I would say that from what I saw inside the government mm-hmm. and continue to see through the eyes of my colleagues, our efforts to engage external audiences, whether it's youth in the Arab world, entrepreneurs in Asia, women in Africa, I think those efforts are expanding, and I'd almost say exponentially. I know some of the people who are working day-to-day on those issues throughout the State Department and the National Security Council are trying to harness new technologies and platforms and engage different partner organizations around the world to do that. There are different offices that handle that. One of the vestiges of the past, in front of the Cold War, is something called the Smith-Mundt, which constrains us a little bit in terms of the way that money is allocated mm-hmm. for these efforts. And I don't want to get too much down that rabbit hole, but some things do need to catch up with current day reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we're speaking to an international audience, you or I here in the United States can easily tap into that and hear the same message. So some of these artificial barriers are antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, there are efforts. And of course, there is the flip side, which is countering negative or, frankly, dangerous messaging and narratives overseas. And in this case, I'm thinking about extremist ideologies, ISIS and others, and there are constant efforts, and in this case, between not only the State Department, but State Department in collaboration with our intelligence agencies and the Defense Department, to find ways to meet these extremist ideologies where they are incubated. And that's online, that's on social media, and that's in the dark recesses of our dark corners of our world. So it's a tough job. I am heartened to see that there are social media companies that are partners in that. Often this is not broadly discussed for obvious reasons, but that is happening. When it comes to messaging within the United States, there's always work to do. It saddens me that it takes something like the tragedy in Benghazi for there to be some sort of focus on the sacrifices that diplomats such as Chris Stevens and others make and have made over the years, and more broadly about the question of security for Americans, regardless of what they put on, whether it's a suit or uniform, overseas. I lament that I think the conversation right now isn't going beyond Benghazi. Mm-hmm. The issues are raised, but then it doesn't go beyond.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the fervor we see in congressional hearings and so on will translate to budget increases or even meeting budget requests that are made. We'll see. But I would hope so. But more broadly, there is, I think, an opportunity, and this is where I bring back in corporate America and organizations such as yours to help convey the message, because there are great benefits to our being engaged, and a lot of it, particularly this campaign season, a lot of those benefits are lost in the shuffle. I'd be heartened to see not only U.S. officials do more hometown diplomacy type of events, but the diplomatic community that calls Washington home, or New York, or San Francisco, or Chicago, to do more as well, to talk about why it's important. For example, the Korean ambassador, the Japanese ambassador, and others I know over the years have made efforts to visit different parts of the United States to talk about the value of their partnership with the United States. When CORUS, the free trade agreement with Korea, was negotiated and up for ratification, Koreans were out talking about it,
right,
talking about why this is important for us and why there's benefits for the United States. When we were working on the New START treaty in the administration, we were engaging groups of all different sizes and interests, whether they were evangelical groups or nonproliferation groups, arms control groups, academic groups, to talk about the importance of this particular treaty, but also the broader effort to strengthen nonproliferation around the world. These take a lot of effort, these steps, and they can be difficult. But hopefully we can cut through the noise and engage people, including Congress, to be partners in this effort. But it does take some time, and you have to look at what does it mean for interests of Americans down the street or across the country.
Well, Ben, we are at, sadly, the last question of our podcast, which is, of course, always, what's next? So, Ben Chang, Managing Director for Burson Mars Teller, which I have said twice now correctly, what's next for us? What do you think the world is going to look like 20 years from now if we can engage our own selves, the American people, on what diplomacy means?
Well, I hope that diplomacy continues to be a thriving industry, if you will, and a career that young Americans can look at as an opportunity to serve their country and engage and discover the world. That's what drove me into the career. That's what continues to motivate me to be a cheerleader for the Foreign Service and, more broadly, careers in international service. As you know, service can come in many forms. That may be taking the exam and getting a black passport, diplomatic
fancy,
passport, very fancy.
Very fancy.
Or it can be through the Peace Corps, or it can be through your school, or it can be through your community organization to do trips. When I was a young lad, I first discovered the world by going to the Soviet Union through youth exchanges, student exchanges.
Cool.
That was back in the time of what we called citizen diplomacy, when, while President Reagan and Gorbachev were kind of feeling each other out, and glasnost and perestroika were in the early stages, you had doctors, you had artists, you had musicians. John Denver met us in Moscow in 1986, trying to really, in a way, pave a new path forward. Those opportunities still exist. It is a complicated world. I don't know, more complex, less complex. It is, in some respects, a mystifying and daunting world. The speed of change abetted by the evolution of communications every month and every year can make it difficult to keep up. And that's, I think we're seeing the effects of that in our society day to day, and particularly amplified by the magnoscope that is the campaign.
Hmm.
So the challenge for communicators, whether in government or not, is to help. How do you manage that? Mm-hmm. How do you still make it about people-to-people engagement while things seem to be going a mile a minute? But ultimately, 20 years from now, to go back to your question, I would hope that diplomacy still serves as a beacon for young people to go in as a career, or mid-level or second career people, as I saw when I joined the Foreign Service, that there is a commitment to service and engagement in the world. And I think even with the rhetoric going on now, there still will be, as long as we stay committed to translating the benefits back to our neighbors and the broader American community. Not always easy, I understand. And there'll be times when choices have to be made, where priorities have to be decided on. But that is the miracle of the American experiment, to go back to your reference to Hamilton. We have a system that, for all the different views that make up the American patchwork quilt, can breathe and flex and be dynamic. For all that we're seeing right now, and there are some sad times, we haven't had a coup.
That's right. Or an attempted coup.
Or an attempted coup. We have institutions like the media and civil society that still have a voice, that have not been bought or co-opted quite yet. We have a fracturing of the media landscape, to be sure. So in 20 years, I would hope that those institutions are still thriving, but that ultimately there is a future in international service.
Ben Chang, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie.